Palestinian people will survive, but the two-state solution may not. What happens then? Well, you accept this apartheid in the 21st century, or will you convert to advocates of the one-state solution of freedom and equal rights for all between the river and the sea? These would be the only options available then.
For decades, the United States and the West have pushed for and failed to broker a two-state solution to resolve the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. Hi, I'm Ahmed Shahabuddin, and today on the stream, we ask, is a one-state solution a more realistic path to peace? Joining us to discuss this, in Ramallah, Noor Oudeh, a political analyst and founding member of the Democratic National Assembly. In Washington, D.C., Khaled Al-Gindi, he's the senior fellow with the Middle East Institute. And in Brooklyn, New York, Omri Bohm, he's a professor of philosophy at the New School for Social Research and author of the book Haifa Republic. And a quick shout out to those of you watching us on YouTube. We invite you to share your thoughts and questions in our live chat, and we will try to bring them into our discussion. Khaled, I want to start with a fact. Some 33%, it seems, of Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip support a one-state solution. I think that's up from about 29% a few months ago. That's according to a recent poll, I should say, by the Palestinian Center for Policy and Survey Research. What do you think is behind this? Why this shift in support, and why are we hearing more about a one-state solution?
Well, I think the probably the most obvious answer to that question is because of the failure of the existing peace process. I mean, it's been going on now for almost 30 years, or actually more than 30 years. And we've had every type of American government, Democrats, Republicans. We've seen Israeli governments left, right, and center. We've had, of course, a Fatah-dominated PLO, but we even had a moment of a Hamas government in the Palestinian Authority. So every possible political combination has been tried. We've seen multiple rounds of negotiations, and they've all failed. And so it's natural that people will turn to alternatives and start thinking about what else is possible. And I would say that it's very significant. I mean, most of these polls are limited to Palestinians in the occupied territories,
right,
in the West Bank and Gaza. And this is the one Palestinian constituency that has been the most favorable toward a two-state solution, really, for the past 50 years. And so the fact that even in this constituency, support for two states is going down and support for one state is going up is really saying quite a lot. Because when you factor in the rest of the Palestinian public in the diaspora, then you see a much more solid majority in favor of one state.
Interesting. I mean, Noor, Israel, some would say, has taken steps in recent years and decades, really, to make a two-state solution seemingly impossible. I mean, chief among them, annexing more of the occupied West Bank, expanding Jewish-only settlements, enshrining that in law. I mean, there are now more than 700,000 settlers living in the occupied West Bank. Maybe the right question to ask, if you will, is not if the two-state solution is dead, but when was it ever alive? When was it properly born? I know we talk about Oslo and 67. I mean, was it ever alive?
Well, if I may, I think we need to ask a different question.
Please.
Which is, what is the root cause of the situation? And the root cause is that there is a settler colonial regime that has oppressed, persecuted, and denied the Palestinian people their rights. Unless this regime is deconstructed and the Palestinian people are allowed to exercise self-determination, then we can talk until our faces turn blue about one state, two state, polka dot state, whatever state you want. And we still won't get a conclusive reality of peace and security for both. Because the reality is, unless we talk about that elephant in the room that nobody wants to talk about, the settler colonial regime, the apartheid regime, from the river to the sea, and deconstruct that, recognize Palestinian rights, recognize the Nakba and the atrocities committed and the consequences of that Nakba, then I don't think that any solution is viable. And I have to say and remind our viewers that there is no solution on the table at this point. The world is content dealing with a right-wing Israeli government that mm-hmm. denies any rights to the Palestinian people, refuses to talk about anything related to political track with the Palestinians.
Yeah.
And so there is no solution in the offing, in the horizon. The world is very happy ignoring the apartheid regime and the settler colonialism that is entrenched in Palestine.
And I appreciate you talking about that point. The world's very happy to ignore it and who the status quo actually serves. Omri, with that in mind, I mean, in your new book, you know, Haifa Republic, A Democratic Future for Israel, you really seem to lay it out or at least explore the possibility that the key to peace is to restructure Israel into a single binational state, which acknowledges the human rights of both Palestinians and Jews and sees them as equal citizens. And you kind of frame it, or it's framed on the back of your book, I should say, that this is kind of the only way to avoid a catastrophe. You know, that word, obviously, for many Palestinians, you know, conjures up the Nakba itself, the catastrophe that happened in 1948. I'm wondering, is it your view that the Palestinian people deserve the right to self-determination? And why, in your mind or in your book, why do you see the two-state solution as not plausible or impossible?
Yeah, well, first, I can say, obviously, it is my view that the Palestinian people have the right for national self-determination. That's the reason why I wrote the book. I fear that if we're going to continue speaking about a two-state solution, then the Palestinian people will not have the right of self-determination. I can agree very much with Nour. I think I would put it in slightly different terms than Nour has put mm-hmm. it in. I think that settler colonialism is part of the problem. I definitely agree that a certain understanding of Zionism, mm-hmm. Zionism as we've come to know it, has excluded the rights of Palestinians on the whole territory, mm-hmm. Jordan River to the sea, their right for self-determination. And I think that if we will not start taking steps towards deconstructing those assumptions, then just as you said, I don't think that even apartheid will be the end result. I think that we're looking at least at the possibility of another Nakba, because people often tend to forget an apartheid is not a solution. Mm. An apartheid is a situation that itself is not stable, and for that reason it has to be resolved in a certain way, and it will be resolved. So if we do not start walking on steps beyond the two-state solution, beyond, again, I agree with Nour, beyond the assumptions that make that situation the case, then we will end up seeing things that are worse than apartheid. And we're already beginning to see them.
And you know, please feel free to jump in. I do want to, you know, discuss some of those things and try to make some of that deconstruction happen on this show. I do want to bring up, though, this idea of, you know, talking till we're blue in the face. You know, 40 years ago, if I'm not mistaken, Nour, in 1982, Jerusalem's deputy mayor, Meron Benvenisti, warned that the establishment of a two-state solution was already, back then in 1982, almost impossible because 100,000 Jewish settlers would soon be living in the occupied West Bank. So now we've added 600,000 or plus, and we see decisions like the one last night from the Israeli Supreme Court after 23 years. It's almost baffling that we're still at this point. So why would the Israeli government be expanding settlements, just to put it simply, Nour, if they were planning one day to have a two-state solution where they would have to remove those 700,000 settlers?
I'm so glad you asked the question, Ahmed, because I think it's important to remind ourselves why the term peace process has become a dirty word in the region. Mm. Why Palestinians cringe when they hear the term two-state solution, because what they've meant over the past 20 or so years is a process by which the United States has absolute hegemony. It basically caters, it makes the world revolve around Israeli demands and Israeli wants and needs. It shields Israel from any kind of accountability. It provides it with all sorts of political goodies and bribes, if you will, to kind of sit on the table with the Palestinians. And now even that is not a demand anymore. Mm. But to make a long story short, it has allowed and enabled Israel to get away with colonial expansion, with land grab, with undermining Palestinian rights, while asking Palestinians for concessions all the time. My problem with the idea that the two-state or the two, you know, the idea of an independent, viable Palestinian state is dead, and so we must look for other formulas, is that it is predicated on the idea that the world revolves around Israeli demands, that everybody must cater to what Israel wants and what Israel will allow to happen. And in a way, that is an endorsement of the colonial status quo. And that is where you lose me as a Palestinian.
Right, and
that is where I find it very problematic. We have to shift the paradigm and start talking accountability everybody else is doing it everywhere else in the world.
Yeah, no, and I appreciate you using that term only as a reflection of sort of the broadening and the widening of the terminology, if not the attempt to apply accountability on the Israeli government. But, you know, we've heard terms like ethnic displacement, ethnic cleansing, apartheid, much more in the public discourse, in the media. Khaled, with that in mind, I want to share with you a video comment that we received from Christian Tabash, an organizer at Harvard College's Palestine Solidarity Committee. He really points to why he thinks the idea of a two-state solution inherently is a sham, and it's very common amongst youth. Take a listen.
The idea of a two-state solution, and more generally, negotiations with the settler colonial state of Israel, have been nothing but a sham, serving as a convenient pretext for Israel to continue its decades-old policy of unabashed settler colonial violence and expansion. This is why we must be directing our energies to putting Palestinian liberation at the center of this conversation by supporting BDS and its uncompromising calls of ending the occupation, extending equal rights to Palestinians in Israel, and recognizing the Palestinian right of return. In many ways, these demands are the prerequisites to any state solution. Because if we're serious about peace, we should be equally serious about the Palestinian call for justice and equality.
So Khaled, he makes the case that we should direct our energy towards BDS to try to hold Israel accountable, to try to bring about change on the ground. What do you make of that? Where should we put our energy?
Yeah, I mean, I think the call for accountability is certainly understandable. If there's one thing, and there are many things missing, but if there's one thing missing from what we used to call the peace process, it is this idea of accountability. Certainly there's been accountability for Palestinians. Palestinians are the single most sanctioned group in the U.S. Congress, of any group on earth. And there are all kinds of levers and pressure points that the international community has to dictate, even in terms of internal Palestinian affairs. But we've never seen any form of accountability on the Israeli side. And considering the huge power asymmetry that is entailed in that, what the result is that we have an even more asymmetrical situation. In other words, the peace process actually contributed to this asymmetry,
right,
by putting pressure on the Palestinians, the weak side, and alleviating any sort of pressure or accountability on the stronger side.
Yeah.
And so now it is, I think, understandable why civil society is stepping in and saying the peace process failed to get accountability. The Palestinian leadership failed to get any accountability. And so the only thing left is things like BDS, which are...
Go ahead, Omri.
Can I jump?
Yes,
can
please,
I jump on
please.
This? So I want to agree and disagree with my friends here. First, I agree that there has to be accountability. Where there is full equality, something that I stand by, then there has to be also accountability for crimes committed, and crimes are committed. So no, to the extent that if your comments seem to suggest that maybe that's not my view, because trying to think how to move forward without that element, that's not my view. I think that you're right, that accountability matters. There should be no compromises on that. However, I also want to say that this is not enough. And unfortunately, I'm not seeing in most of the discussions in which I participate, perhaps I'm not participating in enough discussions, and I'd love to see more, I'm not seeing also the steps beyond accountability. Let's fight for accountability, because I agree it's an expression of the lack of equality that there is no accountability in the Israeli side. Let's discuss what the alternative solution is supposed to look like. What are the steps? Accountability may be one of them. What are the steps on the way to achieving that solution? That's a conversation I very much would love to have.
No, and I would love for Noor or anyone to jump in there. But before we do, and I don't mean to be kind of simplistic about it, but in my understanding, you can't really take those extra steps if there's no willingness from the Israeli people or the international community to actually create that accountability, to take the very early steps. I mean, you know, settlement expansion illegally, creeping annexation, demolishing homes, forcibly removing people from their homes. And again, we mentioned the Supreme Court's decision just yesterday shows that there's no legal recourse, whether you're living as a Palestinian within the state or not. Perhaps I'm sharing my opinion there, but I do want to kind of come back to this idea, if you will, Khaled, of the Palestinian perception of their options. Is declaring a two-state solution no longer viable, somehow seen as, how can I put it, kind of giving up on liberation, kind of like a Palestinians you know, giving up on the idea of the right of return? Why is it so controversial still?
Well, I think it's controversial, certainly for the Palestinian leadership that has invested heavily in the two-state framework and has staked its political existence on achieving that goal, obviously to, you know, without much success. So it's, I understand why this leadership is wedded almost existentially to a two-state solution, because to stand up and say two-state solution is dead is to admit their own political failure over the past quarter century. And so we're not likely to see that. I think it's also very hard to for ordinary Palestinians to completely give up on the idea of two states because of these sunken costs.
Right.
Because you have a Palestinian Authority as dysfunctional and as stagnant as it is.
And as sorry, Khaled, I'm just going to build off what you said to kind of include some of the comments from our YouTube section. I mean, stagnant is one way of putting it, but many people might even say complicit, not just in the occupation, but in this kind of kind of the sense of, you know, no option, no other option. I mean, Noor, as you know, nearly 80% of Palestinians, if I'm not mistaken, want Mahmoud Abbas to resign. We have a comment from Kerry Graham saying, a one-state solution can only work if Israelis are willing to give Palestinians equal rights. Given Israel's proven history and the inherent racism of Zionism, this seems unlikely. Noor, What is the role of the Palestinian Authority, or is there a role? I mean, a lot of people say the first step is to dismantle the Palestinian Authority and then find a real path towards ending the occupation.
Well, I'm you know, I'm not a cheerleader for the current leadership, but I'm not in favor of dismantling the Palestinian Authority, and I have reasons for that, starting with the fact that, look, we are the weaker side in this equation, if you will. We do not have the super powerful army. We're not a superpower in intelligence and alliances with the European Union and the United States. What we have done, though, over the past 50 or 60 years is accumulate a very important, invaluable, really, standing in terms of international law. This is our shield, right? In the past 50 or so years, what we've done is that we've established our rights, our national rights, in international law. There's a whole body of work in international law based or centered around Palestinian rights. To give that up, to give up the legal status of the Palestinian people, of their rights, the international recognition of Palestine as a state, internationally, in return for what? In return for normalizing the existence of settlements, which are a war crime on occupied territory, normalizing the takeover of all of historic Palestine and thus endorsing the Greater Israel Project. this is, I think, where it gets tricky. Even the question, even the polls that you brought up earlier, Ahmed.
Yeah.
When we talk about a one-state solution, I think it depends, for when Palestinians respond, it really depends on what kind of one state they're thinking about.
Right, right.
The PLO, up until 1988, talked about a state for all its citizens, one state democratic for all its citizens, mm-hmm. regardless of religion.
Yeah.
But it wasn't based on Zionism, and it wasn't based on facts created by colonial takeover. We have to make that distinction, and I think if we did,
yeah.
the polls would show you a very different result. Giving up all that standing
yeah.
would leave Palestinians in limbo, and, well, and quite frankly,
yeah.
you know, even though there isn't much confidence
yeah.
in the international system at this point, because it's duplicitous,
yeah.
We'd be left completely naked. And why should we do that?
No, and I think that's a fair point. And Omri, when you hear Noor making this point, right, I do wonder, you know, when we talk about the number of Palestinians and Israelis, I believe the number of Palestinians already exceeds the number of Israeli Jews on the ground. And in a one-state option, it's my understanding the law would no longer be able to continue sort of affording or allowing for Jews all over the world to receive sort of automatic citizenship. What do you make about these two sort of diametrically opposing narratives about who has the right, not only to the land, but quite frankly, to exist as human beings?
Well, I think that what we need to do is to find the logic that would deconstruct the type of exclusionary politics in which the rights of existence of one people will override the rights of existence of another.
Mm.
Again, I want to fully endorse those related topics. Noor is speaking about accountability and
yep.
relatedly, I take it, of international law, and I accept both. I think that they are, they both have to be preserved. If we are to move towards a one-state solution, it has to be the type of one-state solution mm-hmm. that precisely would be argued for mm-hmm. from the perspective also of international law. The fact that a two-state solution and the talk about a two-state solution can no longer respect mm-hmm. International law, as Noor may know better than I do. In fact, not
yeah.
may know. Noor knows better than I do. The fact that international law is not respected. And the fact that international law does not currently defend the Palestinian people, that is something that concerns me a lot. On
mm-hmm.
the other hand,
mm.
As you just said,
mm.
the Palestinians are a majority on the territory. That is something that actually is giving them, I think, the main advantage. The main advantage, if you'd like, in a state that if one day will be created, then actually they will have the power. Something I'm willing to learn to live with,
yeah.
if there will be full equality. That's the type of politics that we need to start thinking about.
Yeah.
My view or my account of a one-state solution is not one that's supposed to be based on Zionism. It's extremely important to say. Again, I'm not sure if this is what Noor was suggesting. Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't. My view is, however,
yeah.
and that's something that I'm extremely interested in debating and talking about with Palestinians, it is that a one-state solution can be consistent with Zionism. It ought not be based on Zionism.
Mm.
My shared life with Palestinians in this region cannot
How?
Be...
How?
How? Just How? Just with the following fact, and this is actually this is something that also goes back to something that Khaled was saying in the following sense, that what I'd like to see Israelis learning to do, and possibly also Palestinians, even though I understand that the cases are not symmetric, is understanding the distinction between sovereignty and self-determination. I think sovereignty ought to belong to all of the inhabitants of Palestine between the river and the sea fully equally. However, self-determination can be exercised despite such equal sovereignty in autonomies, for example. That is, so if we're talking about a binational program,
right.
in virtue of being binational, it asserts the right of self-determination of Palestinians
and
right of self-determination of Jews. And in so far, it is consistent
right.
with Zionism.
And
that is a claim.
And Omri, Noor, you know, we start to dig a little deeper, get a little bit perhaps philosophical, but also in a good way, you know, deconstructing these very messy realities. And I want to thank you all for taking the time to join us today for this discussion. Hopefully, as we said, there'll be many more to come. For those of you watching at home, thanks for joining us. See you next time.